Good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and the music that started the show tonight was a little blurb, a little blip from Nomads, from Zingaya, and it was called Nomads Land. It kind of reminds me of riding on the back of a camel and that, you know, that gait that the camel has as it walks across the sand dunes. I don't know, just kind of enjoy that sort of sexy back and forth, ebb and flow. Anyway, hope you enjoyed it too. And tonight we have a lovely woman. I had the pleasure of co-leading a workshop with a few months ago in Wisconsin, Judika Isles, and I'm so glad to have her with me finally on the show here. We're going to be talking about the Fox Sisters and women's influence in spiritualism. We're going to discuss the controversy around women's spiritualism and the connection between that, the abolitionist movement, the free love movement, and the women's rights movement. Sound interesting? I think so. So stay tuned, because before we get to this interesting subject, or multiple subjects, I have a couple quick announcements and just a brief statement I want to make. First, save the date. Sacred Sundays have started at the Green Man in Hollywood now. Our first service, after being on hiatus for quite a while, was the fourth Sunday in July. And from the feedback from those who came, well, we think we kind of rocked it. So please, save the date. We'll be doing this every fourth Sunday of the month. It's a very eclectic service honoring the divine feminine and sacred masculine. There's singing and sharing and wisdom telling, really a great way to connect with the community and carve out some sacred space for yourself once a month. You can check it out in more detail on my webpage, KarenTate.com. Just go to the Sacred Sundays button and see what that's all about. And I'm one of the Sacred Feminine Priestesses facilitating the service each month, so come out and say hello. Our topic last month was gratitude, and our August service is about harmony. Also, I wanted to tell you about the occupation of Washington that's starting October 6th. It's called Stop the Machine, Create a New World. You can find out more if you go to October2011.org. Here's, you know, their call to action. And it says, October 2011 is the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan and the beginning of the 2012 federal austerity budget. It's time to light the spark that sets off a true democratic, nonviolent transition to a world in which people are free to create just and sustainable solutions. We call on people of conscience and courage, all who speak peace, economic justice, human rights, and a healthy environment, to join together in Washington, D.C., beginning on October 6, 2011, in a nonviolent resistance similar to the Arab Spring and the Midwest Awakening in Wisconsin. A concert, rally, and protest will kick off a powerful and sustained nonviolent resistance to the corporate criminals that dominate our government. 47 years ago, Mario Savio, the activist student at Berkeley, said, and I quote, "There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you cannot take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all," unquote. Those words have an even greater urgency today. We face ongoing wars and massive socioeconomic and environmental destruction perpetrated by a corporate empire which is oppressing, occupying, and exploiting the world. We're on a fast track to make the planet unlivable while the middle class and poor of our country are undergoing the most wrenching and profound economic crisis in 80 years. Stop the machine. Create a new world. It's a clarion call for all who are deeply concerned with injustice, militarism, and environmental destruction to join in ending concentrated corporate power and taking direct control of a real participatory democracy. There's more, but I'm going to stop there. You get the idea. Please go to the website, October2011.org. It starts October 6th, and I would love to hear what you think about it. Also, I want to congratulate Wisconsin, the grassroots support that took back from the GOP two Senate seats for the Democrats. That's what democracy looks like. Let's recall Walker next, Hang in there, Wisconsin. Ohio and Michigan pushback is next, and we just hope you stay strong, and the workers of the United States are behind you. Also, stop the Super Congress. Here's hoping someone in authority actually files suit or takes some action to stop the Super Congress proposed by Obama and the Democrats in the debt ceiling bill. That super committee is giving a dozen congressmen all the power and control, and that subverts our democracy and Constitution. If you don't know about it, take some time to read up on it. The Super Congress is a violation of our Constitution and the system of checks and balances, which is designed to keep legislation from not being passed without sufficient consensus. It's dangerous. It's a slippery slope. No dozen people should have our lives in their hands. That's far too small a body that can too easily be corrupted. And how many of us believe the Democrats will even stand their ground and protect Social Security and Medicare when faced eyeball to eyeball with batshit crazy Tea Party thugs who will never compromise on anything? So get angry, get activated, get organized. Stop the Super Congress, the Tea Party, and the Republican machine. You know, listeners, these people are the antithesis of goddess ideals, which are negotiation and partnership, balance and justice. These are corporate pawns who want to privatize the country and destroy our social safety net. They've already shown they care nothing for working class people. It's up to every one of us to stop them. So I hope I see you in Washington October 6th as we fight to take back our country and stop the machine and create a new world. Remember, Google Super Congress and go to October2011.org. And stay tuned in after our chat with Judica because I want to share an article with you about why evangelicals hate Jesus. It's really interesting, and it might answer the question, if you've been scratching your head, why and how do Christians have such anti-Jesus-like ideas and values? But that brings tonight's announcements and comments to a close until after my chat with Judica. So let me jump into her bio and tell you about all she's accomplished, because she is quite a prolific writer. She is an independent scholar and educator and author of several books of folklore, folkways, and mythology about the subjects of magic, the occult, divination, diverse spiritual traditions, witchcraft, and the paranormal. A paraprofessional crisis counselor, Judica is a graduate of Rutgers University and has a certification in therapeutic aromatherapy from the Australasian College of Herbal Studies. Her books include The Element Encyclopedia of 5,000 Spells, The Element Encyclopedia of Witchcraft, The Encyclopedia of Spirits, The Wiser Field Guide to Witches, and also The Wiser Field Guide to the Paranormal, which is published under her alias, Judith Joyce. And her newest book, The Encyclopedia of Mystics, Saints, and Sages, will be published by HarperCollins in October of this year. So, Judica, thank you so much for making the time to be with us tonight.
Oh, thank you, Karen. Thank you for having me. I'm just delighted to be speaking with you some more.
Well, and I missed you. We had such a good time in Wisconsin, and I feel like we're reconnecting here, so it's extra special.
It was like
special.
Being in college. You know, Karen's room was right next to mine. So
yeah, we shared the bathroom, and we'd go knock on each other's door at midnight, and what you doing?
It was really nice. It was actually better than my college experiences.
Well, listen, this is actually how the idea for this show came about when we were there together in Wisconsin, and you started this subject. You have so many interesting topics to talk about. I mean, the presentation you gave in Wisconsin had everybody enthralled. But you and I started talking about women spiritualists, and I realized I didn't know much about these women at all. So I thought, maybe other people don't either, and so this show was born.
You know, it's a topic that is either sort of shoved under the rug or it's a topic that's held up for mockery. A lot of people who are actually not familiar with the topic are very quick to dismiss the female mediums of the 19th century and the early 20th century, very quick to assume that they must be frauds or that, you know, it's a simple case of, people way back then were so much more gullible than we are. That's really not the case. They're very, very interesting, mysterious. It's a very mysterious, interesting part of our history.
So let's start with what are what is spiritualism? And I mean, I think about, I mean, what comes to my mind, and it's probably the least important, but you, I mean, you tell me, wasn't Abraham Lincoln's wife
yes.
into spiritualism? That's what I think about,
Abraham
and they made her out
too.
To be a nut. Huh?
No. And there is one of the reasons that Mary Todd Lincoln is, people mock her as being, you know, she was a crazy woman, she was a harridan, she was whatever. It is her interest in spiritualism. What is not mentioned is that Abraham Lincoln himself was open-minded, at least, to the topic. It is not clear how interested he was. There were, this material comes from my book, The Weiser Field Guide to the Paranormal, and the book goes into more detail than I can out of my memory. But I believe, and the book will have the exact number, I believe there were approximately 8 seances held in the Lincoln White House. And
wow.
Abe attended at least one of them. Spiritualism, and people confuse the term with being spiritual or spirituality, but spiritualism today is a modern religion. There are a number of, and many of them call themselves churches, if only for the tax benefits. Also, some of them have a Christian orientation. Some of them do not. There are a wide variety of spiritualist beliefs, but the core of spiritualism is the belief that the dead do not disappear, but can communicate and help the living. And that living people have the capacity, some perhaps more than others, have the capacity to communicate with the dead in beneficial ways. So it's not like, you know, scary ghost hunting. It's actually very beautiful, the concept that, you know, that those you have lost can still communicate with you, can still watch out for you, that you can express your love for them. Spiritualism began, it is considered a modern religion with a birthday, and the birthday is March 31st, 1848, because of an event that happened in the home in which the Fox sisters were living, two of the Fox sisters. But it gained steam in the next decades, very specifically because in the Civil War, how many people died?
Well, Judy, let me ask you this before we go on.
Yeah.
So that we understand, is
yeah.
there a difference between spiritualism and, say, I'll give you two examples, the movie Ghost and the
yeah.
ghost hunters we see on TV?
What's
the difference?
Spiritualism believes that, I don't know that they would really categorize them as ghosts or ghosts that haunt, but rather that there is communication between the veils of the living and the dead, and that there are people, it's very shamanic, in
okay.
my mind, and I think in others, because there is, I was looking at some books to prepare for the show, and there is, I cannot remember the title, it's not one of my books, but there is a book on the women and spiritualism, because it's a topic that has fascinated scholars and historians. It's a real turning point in women's independence and in women's emergence in the workforce and in public. But one of the covers of the books is a John William Waterhouse painting of the Oracle of Delphi.
Ah, and, I know that one. Yeah, it's
yeah.
beautiful.
Oh, isn't it a beautiful painting? And
mm-hmm.
there is a real shamanic aspect to it that I think is not always emphasized by a lot of spiritualists. A lot of spiritualists, I think, you know, there's an occultish aspect to this, which I enjoy, but which a lot of people who are spiritualists might not. It is an organized tradition. The center, if you want to call it a center of a religion, is in Lilydale, Buffalo, which is not far, Lilydale, New York, near Buffalo, New York, which is not far from where the Fox sisters come from. It's the Burnt Over District in New York, which is famous for a lot of esoteric and populist religious movements. And every summer, they have, this is the high season there now, they have events throughout the year, but it gets really cold and snowy up there, so the summertime is the time when most tourists come. People flock to Lilydale, and they attend meetings, and there are mediums giving demonstrations of mediumistic skills. they will contact your relatives for you, ostensibly so. You know, I mean, there's always the question of whether it's real or not, but there are many people who insist that they have had very, very real experiences. And it is the core belief is that life does not terminate and that there it is possible for the dead and the living to communicate. Spiritualism was born at approximately the same time as the telegraph, Morse code. The concept that you could communicate across vast distances led to the willingness to believe that if you can do that, why can't you communicate with other planes of existence?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So we're talking seance, or that's just
yes.
one aspect of it.
There are different ways of doing it. There is the traditional seance where the people sit around a table. There's a really interesting book written by Dan Aykroyd's father. And this is actually interesting that you mentioned Ghostbusters. Dan Aykroyd writes the introduction to it. And Dan Aykroyd comes from a family of spiritualists in Canada. And his grandfather was a prominent spiritualist leader, and it's a history of the spiritual movement and also really in-depth descriptions of what actually goes on during a spiritualist service. But spiritualists sometimes, as with the Fox sisters, would go into trance and communicate. So there might not be a traditional seance with the table.
Okay.
The Ouija board, the modern Ouija board, the spirit board,
mm-hmm.
actually derives from these traditions. Because people who wanted to have these experiences in communities where you couldn't muster enough people for a traditional seance, or if you didn't want to pay somebody else to, you know, mediums are often paid professionals. If you wanted to do it at home, just, you know, you and a friend, there goes the Ouija board.
Right, right. Well, speaking of that, I mean, you know, and this is probably just Hollywood stuff, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, you always see that it's kind of dangerous to deal with the Ouija board. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. It's a portal. Any sort of spiritual portal, any sort of spiritual activity, whether a Ouija board or any other sort, you should approach it with love and respect and care. The people who tend to get involved with trouble with Ouija boards are people, A, who approach with fear. And fear, in general, attracts those spirits who feed on fear. It doesn't attract the high-minded, benevolent spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Or it tends to be, you know, the stories you hear tend to be college students, often in Christian colleges, who know they're not supposed to be doing it. And are ambivalent toward it, and so they mock the spirits. They insult them. They summon Satan. They dare something awful to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And spirits often will live up to your expectations. If you ask them to do something, you know, you can't. You know, imagine just walking down the street. If you start insulting a stranger, how will they react?
Exactly.
Well, speaking of portal.
Well, that's a good point, too. And again, they're probably coming either from a place of ridicule or fear, so they're putting negative in, so they get negative out.
I have issues, personally. I don't think it's safe to summon unknown spirits. In my experience, that's like, I'm a city girl. In my experience, that's like throwing your door wide open and saying, anybody in the street, come on in.
That's a good analogy.
Well, you know, those who are busy, would you have the time to just walk in? I wouldn't.
Right.
Those who have the time to just show up unbidden tend to be of ill repute.
So
I like named spirits.
Well, that's what I was about to say. If you were going to do it, would you, like, invoke a goddess using a Ouija board, for instance?
You could. Sure, you could. Or a relative, somebody you know.
Right. Well, speaking of the portal, I know we kind of got off the track. I want to go back to the Fox sisters, but
doesn't matter.
The portal,
stream of consciousness.
I'm wondering, you know, can anything be a portal other than a Ouija board? Can it be something that a relative owns or something?
Images in particular, mirrors, photographs.
Okay.
Do you remember, I had this book in my childhood, Dallaire's Greek Mythology.
Okay.
It's still sold. It's a very popular book. I have heard so many people tell me that that was what awakened their goddess consciousness, their love of either goddesses in general or specific. And it's not the text, which is sort of archaic and out of date, but the images.
In the same way that
I'm a tarot card reader, in the same way that cards, any sort of an image, especially a powerfully spiritual one, can serve as a portal.
And say the title of the book again?
It's the author's, Dallaire, Dallaire. It was a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Dallaire. And it's Greek mythology. They have numerous books. There's a book on Norse mythology also.
Okay.
Really beautiful illustrations. It's a children's book.
I wonder who did
book.
The art, if it was one of the Dallaires.
Yeah.
Well, let's get back to the Fox sisters. So were the Fox sisters like the beginning of women's spiritualism?
Unknowingly. Okay. March 31st, 1848, the night before April Fool's Day, which is significant. The Fox sisters were the youngest, I believe, in a family of six. There are actually three Fox sisters who become professional mediums, but there are only two. The eldest sister also, but they're only the two youngest, Maggie and Kate, ages approximately 14 and 11, were in the house. They had lived in Canada for a while. Their parents had a bit of a tempestuous marriage. Their father drank, or drank at times, and the parents were separated for a while, but they had gotten back together and had moved into this cottage. They had rented a cottage. They were not wealthy people. I believe Mr. Fox was a blacksmith. Mrs. Fox came from a family with a reputation for second sight. So this is not the first manifestation of psychic ability in the family. But they had moved into this house. They were living there for a couple months. And ever since they had moved in, and this is documented because they had complained to their neighbors, there was just weirdness in the house, strange phenomena. If this had been happening today, they'd be on a Ghost Hunters TV show. But back then, it was a conservative area. They were Methodists. There was knocking and rapping in this little house. There were just noises coming from the ceiling, from the floors. There were noises coming from all over, all hours of the day. It kind of creeped them out. And they lived like this for several months until on March 31st, Kate, finally, I should probably get out the book and read it directly, but she stamped her foot and she addressed whatever was doing the knocking. She addressed it as Mr. Splitfoot, which is a euphemism for the devil, you know, the cloven-hoofed ghost spirit, but may just have been because he bedeviled them. You know, he was a thorn in their sides, whatever it was. And she addressed it, and it knocked back at her. And she and her sister started this thing where they would clap, and whatever it was would clap back. And then they worked out a thing where, you know, if I'm going to ask you a question, and if the answer is yes, clap once. No, clap twice. At some point, they went to get the neighbors. Neighbors were, by the next morning, there were all sorts of, you know, dozens of people in the house. The Fox sisters had worked out a system with whatever was in the house, matching letters to numbers of claps. And a story came out that this thing making all the noise was the ghost of a murdered peddler who accused previous inhabitants of the house of murdering him. Those people eventually took them to court for slander, although nothing ever came of it. It was discovered that the people before them, who had rented the house before them, a young couple, had left the house because they couldn't stand all the noise, all this sort of supernatural activity. You know, by today's standards, if it was happening in 2011, 2012, you know, now, it would just be a haunted house story, poltergeist.
Right.
But back then it was very scandalous, and the concept that people could communicate with the dead was mind-blowing. The ghost started to answer questions incidentally years later, years after the Fox sisters, I believe in 1904, years after the house was abandoned, they did find a skeleton in the house, you know, hidden in the house. So who knows? Even then, people didn't really believe the story. People were convinced that they were making it up. It did not work to their benefit initially. They were thrown out of their church within weeks. They were accused of being witches. Mrs. Fox, the mother, her hair went white overnight. They had to get out of town. People were very, very hostile to them. They were attacked numerous times. People perceived them as devil worshippers or being in league with unclean spirits. They ended up living with their sister, Leah. And Leah is, in some ways, I think, the most fascinating of the Fox sisters. She was 35 at the time. She was something like 21 years older than her youngest sister. She was the eldest of the Fox children. When she was 14, the same age that Maggie was when she first communicated with whatever this thing was, she got married, had a baby, and her husband abandoned them. Everybody told her to go home to her parents because that's what young women did. And you have to appreciate for, you know, and I suspect your listeners do, but for people who are unaware, women just, you know, women didn't work.
Right, there
poor
was no
women,
work for them outside the home, really.
Opportunities were so limited, especially for sort of middle-class women. You know, the jobs that were available were, you know, prostitution or really, really menial work.
Mm-hmm.
There was no, you know, there was no, oh, I'll be a secretary, I'll be a doctor, I'll be a lawyer, I'll be, you know, I'll just go work in a store, I'll do retail. Women really could not work, which would eventually become the bane of Maggie Fox's life because she does become a working woman and the man she fell in love with was appalled by this.
That she worked?
Yeah.
Oh, because it wasn't the way of the times.
He was a wealthy man. It was scandalous.
Right.
Leah Fox, even as this young teenager, refused to go home. She said she could support herself. And she started giving piano lessons.
Ah.
And she gave piano lessons for her, and she was able to support herself and her daughter, who was, you know, not much older than the Fox sisters. When her two younger sisters, the Rochester Rappers, as they're known sometimes, when they were drummed out of their community, they went to stay with Leah. It was a huge, huge scandal. The girls were very pretty. They were media sensations. People were tramping in and out. They were constantly tested. Everybody wanted to debunk the Fox sisters. No one was gullible. They were never debunked. They were strip searched. They were, you know, they would do demonstrations barefoot with their skirts tied around their knees so that people could see their legs, make sure they weren't cracking their toes, which was the rumor of how they were making the noises, because the sounds would materialize around them. Wherever the Fox sisters went, the noises that they had encountered in the house followed them. Eventually, Leah lost all her customers because people didn't want to be associated with, you know, a scandalous family who was in the newspaper. And
so now, did Leah have the gift, too?
She was their facilitator. I don't know. Kate is supposedly the one who had the best gift. Kate was also a healer. She healed. We were talking about women's rights initially. Something else that happened the same year as the Fox sisters' encounter with the spirits is the Seneca Falls Convention, you know, which is credited as the first women's rights convention, also in Upper New York State. Kate is credited with healing Elizabeth Cady Stanton's brother. He had neuralgia. He was a homeopathic physician, but Kate, through she had the ability to heal, is credited with healing him, and you know, according to him. Leah was the one. All these people were tripping in and out of her house. They were just testing them, and Leah was the one who finally said, "Look, this isn't working." They were starving. They had no money. She lost her customers, and she said, "You know what? We're going to rent a theater, and we will charge $1 a ticket, and people can come and see our demonstrations." And she is perceived as sort of the mastermind behind the spiritualist movement. She never charged more than a dollar. They never became wealthy, as opposed to other people. I think especially people who weren't genuine, people who saw this as a way of bilking the gullible.
Right.
Charged a lot more money and made more money.
Well, and that's how we think of it, I think, most of the time. You know, we always see it, because, I mean, look at Houdini. Houdini said, if this is all true, you know, I'll come back. And, you know, to our knowledge, I don't think he ever actually came back and communicated with his wife, huh?
Well, that's actually in the Weiserfield Guide to the Paranormal. It's a controversial point. At one point, his wife did say that a medium came back. But there was some question about whether that was fraudulent or not, and then she never really discussed it again. The thing with Houdini is that Houdini did believe in the possibility of communication with the dead.
Mm-hmm.
He had a huge occult library. He was an expert in all sorts of magic, not just sleight of hand magic, but he really, really despised frauds.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, it became an obsession with him, going and exposing different mediums. The Fox sisters are before him, though. The Fox sisters are at the beginning. A lot of the more prominent, Victoria Woodhull, a lot of the more prominent mediums are a decade or two decades after the Fox sisters. The Fox sisters are really the pioneers. They never really profited from it. Leah perhaps the most, because she was older and she had a financial sense. She became an author. And one of the things with women in spiritualism at a time when, comparable to George Sand, the early publishings of the Bronte sisters, at a time when women who wrote fiction had trouble publishing as women, they would adopt male names or neutral names.
Mm-hmm.
Women, the spiritualist mediums, were considered authoritative and published books, both Leah Fox writing a spiritualist manifesto and then Maggie Fox later writing what she described as the death blow to spiritualism. They both were published authors under their own names. The concept that women had something to say, even though at the beginning what they had to say was often channeling men, but the concept that women could become public speakers and that people would listen to them respectfully really, really owes a debt to the spiritualists, those early spiritualists.
So in the controversy around women as spiritualists is because women were thought to just, be quiet in your home, and they just sort of took this into this entrepreneurial place and just sort of went gangbusters with it, with the theater and all?
There was a concept, and going back to, and you could argue that this is stereotypes of women as witches, there was a willingness to believe that, and there were many, many famous male mediums also. So there are both female and male mediums. But the concept was that women might have a gift, might have an aptitude for being mediums. There was a willingness to accept women as mediums and that they were authorities. What happened was that you had women who were standing on a stage and basically owning the stage. They were not the magician's assistant.
Right.
This was unheard of at the time. It was unheard of for the time, and it was not respectable. And it was nebulous, because an actress, actresses were at that time lumped in with prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
That was clearly a certain type of disreputable profession. And then, you had the upstanding woman who, had her children and was at home and was modest and obeyed her husband. And that was, for a lot of people, something that was very clear. That was clearly a role model, a good thing. But
mm-hmm.
the spiritualists were in the middle, because they were not.
Right.
Often they were modest women. They were spiritual women. They were not prostitutes. They were not. But there is a theatrical aspect to it. As it became more popular, the earliest people involved with spiritualism, and I think the people who are involved with it today, the true believers who remain, were spiritual in orientation, but in the middle, you had people who were just fascinated and wanted to see it as entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
even a real medium, you know, the spirits don't always speak on command. So I think even genuine mediums felt pressured to fake phenomena sometimes.
Right.
Because it became a show.
Yeah, and they had to, if they didn't perform one, they thought they were fake. But if the
right.
spirits weren't talking, they weren't talking.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So would we classify that Guy von Prague and like the Ghost Whisperer show? Would that sort of fall into this category?
Yeah. John Edwards. Yeah.
John Edwards.
People like that. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. I'm just curious, and if you don't want to comment here, just say so.
Sure.
But do you have a sense of John Edwards and the von Prague guy? I mean, I've
I don't
heard
know
so much controversial stuff about him, you know?
I will tell you what I know, and I have to tell you that I'm coming to the end of my most recent book. I'm doing my last edits right now, and it struck me that in the past 10 years I have written 4 really, really big encyclopedias, and I say that because I have spent a good part of the last 10 years in a room writing. I know my topics, if you want to talk about witches, if you want to talk about spirits or saints, but there's an awful lot I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know von Prague at all. I don't watch television, minimally. I have had people tell me that they've had very accurate, real experiences with John Edwards. People who I respect have told me that they have had those experiences. I had an experience with Derek Acora, who had a bit of a scandal. I don't even know what it was. He was on he's British, and I think he was on the Travel Channel for a while. I don't know if he still is, but I had a reading from him, a spontaneous reading. I met him at a social situation, and he came over and took my hand, and was amazing. So I don't know what anybody else says about him, but in my case, he was absolutely, absolutely amazing, and I liked him very much. But
so
I can only speak
listener,
to my experience.
Well, Judika, if a listener wanted to seek out a real spiritualist, do any names come to mind that, you know, you would feel like...
Raymond Buckland.
Oh, okay.
Raymond Buckland, who is more famous for his work with Wicca.
Uh-huh.
But actually comes, but is also a spiritualist, and who teaches at Lilydale. If I were interested in having that kind of an experience, and I was not familiar, I would probably try to go to Lilydale over the summer.
Okay.
Because over there, the Lilydale community polices these things very, very closely. They
mm-hmm.
watch, you know, they want to make they watch over their own reputation. I have met people who teach over there. I have no experience of their work, so I can't say one way or the other, but, you know, they seem to be pleasant people for what that's worth. But Raymond Buckland has really wonderful books on spiritualism, and I would say that he is the person that if I were looking for an individual, he's the person I would go to, and he's in the United States. Or
okay.
just go to Lilydale. There are other spiritual camps. There's a place in Florida. There's, I think, someplace in Wisconsin.
Is the Edgar Cayce people in the same sort of category?
No, Edgar Cayce, and I don't think they would like to be categorized that way. Edgar Cayce had different types of trances, and he is also, there's also, you're kind of going through my book here.
Okay.
But, the way
unknowingly. I haven't looked at it yet.
Oh, no,
so,
I mean, because there is an entry for Cayce and for Harry Houdini. Arthur Conan Doyle, who was very, very involved with spiritualism, which led to a rift with Harry Houdini, who was at one time his good friend, Arthur Conan Doyle being most famous as the author of the creator of Sherlock Holmes. But,
no, wait, was that controversy about the fairy pictures in England, or was that something totally different?
That is different.
Okay.
Arthur Conan Doyle's second wife was a medium. And she decided that she was going to read for Harry Houdini. And there are numerous ways of contacting the spirits or contacting the dead. Seances are one way. Automatic writing is another way, and there are descriptions in the book of exactly what automatic writing is. She sat down with him and claimed that she had contacted his mother, and Houdini was very close to his mother. And I come from a similar background, ethnic background, as Harry Houdini. I understand his objection here, sort of. I understand the story. One of the things that a medium is supposed to be able to do, a real medium, is essentially you become a channel. You don't have to know the information. I'm a card reader. I'm not that kind of a medium, but I am a card reader, and I often tell people things about their business that I don't understand. And I'll tell you, you know, I don't know what kind of, I don't know the machinations of their business, but I can tell you what the cards say. Likewise, a medium should be able to, if they're channeling somebody from Spain, they should be able to, you know, the voice should come in Spanish, even if the medium doesn't speak Spanish. And there are mediums who are famous for this. There are mediums who could speak all sorts of languages in trances that when they were not entranced, they could not. Anyway, Mrs. Conan Doyle, first she put a cross on the top of the page, and then she wrote a message in English, which Houdini became livid because, A, his mother was the wife of a rabbi. She was Jewish, and she would never have, you know, she wouldn't have used a cross.
And she probably would have used Hebrew letters, right?
She would have used something, exactly. She would have done something like that.
Right.
And, two, she never really spoke English. She spoke Hungarian. And if it was a real message, it should have come out like that. And the wife eventually backtracked. She said the cross wasn't while she was in trance. That's what she did to, you know, protect from, you know, negative spirits. But it ruined their friendship because, you know, basically Houdini accused, who was an Aries, who accused, you know, Doyle's wife of being a liar. And Doyle didn't take kindly to that, and they never, you know, really rekindle their friendship after that.
Right, right. Well, he felt duped, you know, duped by a friend.
He was angry. He took this stuff very personally. It became an obsession with him. It's not just something he would do once in a while. Harry Houdini put an awful lot of effort. He would get dressed up in disguises and attend seances. And he was a stage magician, and at that time, a lot of stage magicians, if you look at old posters, They reproduce a lot of it involves spirits, conjuring spirits, but they never made a pretense of it being real.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was what outraged Harry Houdini. Houdini had friends among the spiritualists. He learned the magician's cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
There is based on a spiritualist tool. It looks a little bit like a confession box, a confessional.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory is that first of all, it concentrates the energy, and it gives us the medium privacy. And Houdini was friends with the Davenport brothers, who were famous early mediums, and they taught him how to use the box. And, of course, it has always now lent suspicion on the Davenports because, you know, were they real or were they frauds? There are a number of mediums, including the Fox sisters, who were never debunked, even though people tried very, very, very hard actively to debunk them, which doesn't mean that they're real, but if they weren't real, then that was some really good trick.
Right, they were pretty consistent, it seems like.
A lot of people claim Maggie Fox at one point. The two sisters had very sad lives at the end. They both became alcoholics.
Did they ever marry and have children? Or?
Yeah, Kate got married, and she was happy for a while. She had two children, moved to England, and then her husband died. And it became difficult because, you know, I think while she was married, she didn't really have to support herself. Maggie has a very tragic love story. She fell in love with a hero, a celebrity, an explorer, Alicia Cook. Their papers are, I think, online. You can read some of their love letters. He came from this mainline Philadelphia family, very elegant. and he liked her, and they may have gotten married. That's, you know, she was certainly called Mrs. Kane, and they may have gotten married secretly, but he was ashamed of her. She had a limited education. She was, you know, she worked.
Right.
He encouraged her. He sent her to school. He sent her to finishing school. He tried to make her into, he tried to mold her into someone his family would like.
Mm-hmm.
He encouraged her to convert to Catholicism, which he did, because dogma forbid raising spirits.
Right.
So he essentially took away her income.
Interesting.
But then go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you were, you know, telling me when we were deciding what we were going to talk about on the show, that this, that spiritualism, and finish up on the Fox sisters, but I also want to get to how this connects to the abolitionist movement and the free love movement and the women's rights movement.
Well, it's all connected, actually. Sojourner Truth, Greeley, Horace Greeley, they were all aficionados of the Fox sisters. It is one of the reasons that the spiritualists, I think, have been, especially the women, have been shoved under the rug. A lot of the early, really early, 1850, the Fox sisters give their first professional appearance in 1850. So those, the earliest people who they were involved with were Quakers, were people who were involved in the abolitionist movement, and involved in the women's rights movement. In the public eye, they became very connected. I don't know if you've ever discussed Victoria Woodhull on your show.
No.
First woman. Well, Victoria Woodhull, the first woman to ever run for president. And she was a medium.
Ah.
She was a medium, and she was also associated with the free love movement, and it became very scandalous. They all became sort of entwined together. These different movements. There were a number of people who overlapped. A lot of people who were involved with the abolitionist movement were interested in the spiritualist movements and attended seances. Simultaneously, there were people who were interested in the women's rights movement and who, in particular, were fascinated by these women. The mediums were sort of the first professional women who were not serving men, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
They were just independent professionals with a skill, competing in the marketplace with men as equals, and not paid less, and not treated as less. And so I think that was a fascination in the birthplace of the modern women's rights movement. Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Also, not far from the birthplace of modern spiritualism, around the same time. However, as the free love movement became, as I think in Reconstruction and even during the Civil War, as these issues came to the fore, you know, they stopped being fringe movements and became very much in the public eye. Associations with the occult, which is how spiritualism was associated, and with free love, which for many people was associated with immorality, became very uncomfortable. And so they were kind of shoved under the table.
Well, now, I might have the timing off, so, you know, forgive me, I'm not very good with dates. But could any of this sideline stuff, you know, these topics we're talking about, could this have anything to do with why the suffragettes had such a hard time trying to get the women to vote, you know, just trying to get them arrested, institutionalized, all of that stuff? Were they saying they were crazy women because they were into this other stuff too?
Well, I think that's what they wanted to avoid, yeah. I mean, it's not the only reason. But it's
it is one of the reasons,
yes. And the desire to be really, really rational and scientific, and we are not crazy women, and we are not immoral women, and we are not associated with any fringe movements. We are rational just like men. That is very much the, for a lot of people, becomes a very important issue, just that desire to not be sort of tainted by anything that could be perceived as craziness or superstition or backwardness.
You know, you're reminding me of a guest I had on the show. I mean, this fits right into it. He was talking about all the people in history who changed history, but you know, they were sort of like forgive the phrase I'm going to use, but sort of the lowlifes of society.
Yes.
How they actually changed society. And he was talking about how the madams in the prostitution houses used to actually, you know, they were these women entrepreneurs. They actually took care of the women in their houses, and the women had it pretty good. But it was the suffragettes, the ones who were trying to get the vote, because they wanted to be associated, like you just said, with, you know, the proper and above board rational mind stuff.
They deserve to have the vote.
Yeah. So they wanted, you know, they sort of, differentiated themselves from these other women. You know, they sort of demonized them and, sort of played the game of the culture rather than supporting these other women. And I don't know, I'm just thinking about that as you're saying this.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
So in a way there was really an ugly underbelly to idea of women getting the vote. I mean, if that's what they,
a lot of mediums and spiritualists were, and not all spiritualists are mediums, you know, and not all mediums are spiritualists. I mean, a lot of spiritualists were involved in the suffragette movement and the women's rights movement, but for a lot of other members of the women's rights movement, the early women's rights movement, this became an embarrassment.
Mm.
You know, these were not the people they wanted to represent them.
Right. As I can see, the madams wouldn't have either, you know.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Even though they.
Horace Greeley, at one point, the Fox Sisters really became a national sensation. At one point, they toured Europe. They were in New York, and Horace Greeley, the publisher, took them under his wing. And at one point, he really encouraged them to charge more money for tickets,
mm-hmm.
specifically to to keep the riffraff out.
Right.
And Leah refused for whatever reason. I don't know why she refused, but she always maintained her tickets at $1 a ticket, even though other people were charging much more.
Mm-hmm.
But there was always this, you know, mediums eventually, post-World War II years, you end up, you know, the only place you can see a medium other than in very quiet spiritualist enclaves is at a circus or a carnival.
Well, I was about to say, it sort of reminds me of vaudeville. Did they ever venture into vaudeville?
It is sort of pre-vaudeville. This becomes, in a way, vaudeville comes out of this, because vaudeville builds on this foundation and broadens it. So, you know, you have singers and dancers and acrobats also. As you know, it becomes just entertainment, where you have conjurers, and conjurers are more predictable. People who are doing it as tricks, it's a show,
mm-hmm.
and it's predictable. You know, there's a control over it. When you are working with spirits, I mean, speaking as someone who does, you know, as a reader, it's unpredictable. You don't know where you're going to go. You don't know if they'll materialize. You don't know which ones will materialize. It's, you know, you serve the spirits, but when you are a conjurer, you know, you have command of your tricks and the show. You know, if you're supposed to do a 90-minute show, you will do a 90-minute show.
Yeah.
Interestingly, women in this sort of controlled entertainment type of magic are reduced to, you know, the pretty assistant who gets thrown in half.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They lose the autonomy that the true spiritualists or, you know, posers pretending to be mediums, you know, either way, but pretending to be real ones, they're women.
Well, now, you said a minute ago, spiritualists aren't mediums and mediums aren't spiritualists. Can you explain the distinction?
there are spiritualist mediums, but not all spiritualists are mediums, and not all mediums are spiritualists. Mediums are, the term medium refers to an oracle or any sort of bridge between realms. So if you go back to the Bible, the Witch of Endor is actually more accurately called the medium of Endor, because she brings up the soul of Samuel and communicates with the dead for a client. The priestesses of Delphi, the Pythonesses, the Sibyls, you could describe all of them as mediums. Medium is a job. It's a profession. Mm-hmm. It's a skill.
Okay.
And there are spiritualist mediums, in the same way that there might be mediums of other spiritual schools. Spiritualism, though, is a belief system having to do with, you know, at its most basic explanation, having to do with the ability of the coexistence of the living and the dead. The dead do not disappear.
So it's not necessarily a job, is the distinction.
Spiritualism is a religion.
Okay, one's religion, one's a job. Okay, I get it now. Okay.
A skill. Yeah,
right.
I mean, not all mediums, you know, not all mediums charge. There are mediums who do it, you know, as a spiritual exercise. So I guess at that point you wouldn't call that, you know, if you're not paid, is it a job?
Right.
It's a skill. It's an ability. It's a service.
Okay. Well, are there other mediums like today, prominent female spiritualists of today, or you know, from the past that you want to make sure we mention before we wrap it up?
The Fox sisters, and I think the other ones that I find so fascinating are the Bang sisters, another pair of sisters, early spiritualists, and they are famous as the creators of precipitated spirit portraits. You can see these if you go to Lilydale, there's a museum. These are paintings. There are two sisters and there are a pair of men, the Campbell brothers, who are also famous as the creators of this type of painting. It is also a spiritual art. The creation of these paintings is also known as a seance. Ostensibly, they're not made by human hands. They just materialize on the paper,
wow,
on the canvas. They have been tested. You know, no one knows how they're made. No one has been able to reproduce them. So if they're a fraud, they're a good one. The closest example I can give is Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico,
mm-hmm,
City.
Oh, I was thinking about that, but I didn't,
yes,
didn't mention it because I thought, oh, I couldn't possibly.
No.
Thing.
That is, and it's the same sort of thing where the pigments can't be reproduced, and there's a powdery quality to it. Very similar. It's described as being similar to the powder on a butterfly's wings, that kind of texture, and it is characteristic of both the Virgin of Guadalupe and the precipitated spirit portraits, and they're fascinating. And if, you know, go Google them and take a look and see what they look like. Because
now, the Shroud of Turin isn't in this category.
No, but it will be written about in the next book. That's another interesting. That is another interesting, and I have a bit of a scandalous story with that one, but you have to wait for the next book to come out.
All right, so tell us a little bit about your books that are out. I mean, I know they're all like huge tomes, 700 and 800 pages, right?
I have 4 encyclopedias, 2 field guides, and 2 little books of magic. 3 are available now. Encyclopedia devoted to magic spells from all around the world, different styles of magic, different schools of magic. An encyclopedia of witchcraft, which at the moment is, I think, only available as an e-book in the United States, is available as a traditional book outside the U.S., and that's a just overview of all sorts of things having to do with witchcraft and witches. Encyclopedia of Spirits for the goddess advocates, lots and lots of goddesses, deities of all kinds from all over the world. And the book that is coming out in October is the Encyclopedia of Mystics, Saints, and Sages, and it's very much, I guess, an interfaith book, a book of saints and holy people, miracle workers from different spiritual traditions, and a lot of very, very interesting stories, and there is a little bit of an analysis of the Shroud of Turin, an unconventional one, because, you know, there are all sorts of other books with the conventional ones already, so, you know, why waste the paper on what, you know, somebody else has already written. And then I have these 2 little field guides, which are, I guess, about 200 pages, and for me that's a little book. There's the Wiser Field Guide to Witches, which has different information than the Element Encyclopedia of Witchcraft. But it's you know, if you like witches, you'll like the book. And The Weiserfeld Guide to the Paranormal, which I think is kind of like the greatest hits of the paranormal. People talk about all sorts of topics and assume that everyone knows what they're talking about. The Fox sisters and Barney and Betty Hill, who were the first couple to reputedly, the first documented couple to be abducted by aliens and to come forward with their story, and all sorts of other spiritualists and mediums, and all kinds of mysterious stories that can't really be explained, and I try to explain them.
So, if out of all of the folks, who did you find the most intriguing or provocative? Whose story?
Very much the Fox sisters. They're written off often by people who assume that they must be frauds because what happened can't be true. It can't be true, therefore they must be frauds. But they really seem to me, for me, I really see this shamanic tendency in them. Even, it didn't necessarily serve them, their experiences. They didn't really profit personally from their experiences. In the beginning, they try to, as best as we can see, they attempted to live sort of very normal lives and put this behind them, but the spirits, or spirit, really, and they channeled many spirits, not just this peddler. And there were all sorts of documents from people who, you know, they had read for, who claimed they were very, very helpful, particularly Kate Fox. And it really strikes me, and I don't think they knew. They were not people who were educated in esotericism, but a lot of their story corresponds to the belief that if the spirits want to work with you, it's an old shamanic belief, an international shamanic belief, if the spirits want to work with you, they will pursue you.
Right.
Until you do. I don't think they knew that, but that is very much what their story sounds like. So something was going on there.
So they didn't have, like, one or two particular spirits that sort of, for lack of a better word, I don't mean haunt them, but sort of stalk them.
Kate Fox spent a lot of time taking the Swedish cure for alcoholism over the years. And she, while she was in this sanitarium, would give seances for the people, you know, for the doctors in charge and their families and you know, the people who were also in the sanitarium. And there are records of her, just descriptions of her channeling all sorts of spirits of every kind and just people having phenomenal experiences. Maggie Fox on her deathbed was very poor and was living in a, she was eventually homeless at the end of her life, but was living in a room in New York City on 57th Street and had a nurse from a doctor, not spiritualist, not occulty in any way, a doctor who would come and visit her daily. She was paralyzed. Her hands and feet were paralyzed. There were no closets or armoires in the room, and yet the doctor claimed that there were these knocking, rapping noises all the time. So what was that? Who knows?
Well, you know, you make me think about the woman who built the Winchester House.
Yeah, Sarah Winchester. Isn't that a great story?
Yeah, Sarah Winchester,
yeah.
And I was also just, it just went in and out of my head so quick. I wish I could. Oh, Ram Dass. Isn't Ram, you know, that's sort of a channeled thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have the right name there,
I think,
Ram?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what we're talking about? Huh?
Do you know Seth, the Seth Speaks book?
Yeah,
do you remember
Seth
those?
Speaks.
Jane Roberts?
Yes.
Because that's in the Weiserfeld Guide to Witches. And do you know that Jane Roberts, initially, her first contact with Seth was through a Ouija board?
Ah, okay.
You know, and that is, who knows? You know, the question is, you know, who is the skeptic? The person who, you know, the person who doesn't, you know, acknowledge this, or the person who, if somebody is so convinced that these things cannot happen, I don't know if they get to be called skeptics at that point, or the person who is willing to, you know, accept the possibility that, you know, the world is just full of
things we don't know.
Yeah, things we don't know. Mysteries.
Well, you know, let me start to wrap it up with this thought, and maybe you have a comment about it. You know, I go back to thinking about the show with John Edwards and how he would pick people out of the audience, and he had somebody there who wanted to talk to them. The conversations were the most rudimentary conversations. From your research, you know, with all this documentation, were those, you know, those sorts of accounts as rudimentary as what you'd see John Edwards? Was that it, John Edwards?
Yeah.
Do I have the right name?
Yeah, you do.
Because I'm thinking, you know, the politician, John Edwards.
Yeah, I know. It's confusing. They varied. You would get a lot of very rudimentary.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, and it's very interesting. There's another phenomenon that has nothing to do with this, but you're reminding me of the phone calls from the dead. And they're always, you know, the phone calls are all very kind of, they never tell you the big mysteries. Like, no one calls, no one, there are no phone calls for the dead that anyone is revealing that explore the mysteries of the universe. It's always something like, I love you, honey. You know, the safe deposit key is in the other room. It's something very, very concrete.
You see,
it's almost mundane.
That's what makes me skeptical about it, you know,
unless
that's the most important thing the spirit wants to say. That's more important to them to say, I love you, honey, the key is in the other room, rather than what it's like on the other side. I, you know, can't they answer one more question? You know, what's it like?
I don't know. It's a good question. I think a lot of it depends on who, what the person who is being addressed wants to hear,
right,
or what the person, or you know, if or if you think that they're being frauds, what the medium presumes that they want to hear, and often that what they want to hear is, I love you, honey,
right,
you know, sometimes that's what you really want to hear. I don't know. I mean, that's a very good question. It does run the gamut. A lot of people, and there are, you know, if you get into the Seth material with Jane Roberts, it is very, very mystical and abstract.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people who won't read it for that reason, because
right.
it's not concrete enough for them.
Well, and look how the Oracle of Delphi, that was supposed to be unintelligible too. You know, when the priests supposedly.
Oh, that's another show. But that may be because the priests like drugged the priestesses.
Or they had a political agenda and wanted
there is a thought that before there were the priests, when it was a shrine to Gaia, they may not have been quite that unintelligible. But they may have overdosed them on whatever the fumes was to the point where they were unable to communicate intelligibly at that point.
Yeah, and then the priest said what he was paid to say, or you know, whatever his benefactor
his
could
agenda.
Benefit from.
Right.
Well, Judika, this has been fun. Anything we haven't that I haven't asked you that you feel like you want to say to just sort of round it all out?
No, I just love speaking with you.
Well, thank you. Ditto. I enjoy talking to you, too, and I look forward to our paths crossing again. Well, do you have a website or anything like that where listeners
can
find you?
The website is under construction, but it's my name, JudikaIlles.com. I am probably easier to find. I'm finishing up the book, and until the book is done, I can't finish up my website. So probably the easiest place to get in touch is on Facebook or on Twitter.
Ah, that's right. You are on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So if somebody wanted to get a reading from you or something like that, do you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I love doing readings.
Okay,
you know,
wonderful.
The irony of life is I would rather do readings than write.
Well, you have to start shortening these books, you see, or making them into different volumes so that, you know, it's a little easier on yourself.
I know. It's like, you know, but you kind of find a niche and then they keep expecting you to do sort of the same thing.
Yeah. Well, listen, this has been fun. And so when your next book is out, let me know. You can come back on the show
October.
And we'll talk about it.
Okay, definitely.
All right. Love to you, and, you know, good luck on finishing up.
Thank you.
All right, good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, a hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking, the feminine consciousness, and all of that, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these benchmarks and values have the capacity to save the world. And you've been listening to Judika Isles discussing with me women in spiritualism. I hope you had as much fun as I did. I thought that was great stuff, and I thank Judika for her insights. And that sound means that we're sort of crossing the threshold into the second part of the show. And I wanted to first thank a couple listeners who have made some donations to help support the show. The first is Chris, and the second is Wes. And between the two of them, we have about 4 or 5 months of shows paid for. So I really, really, really want to extend my thanks to Chris and to Wes for their support of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. So, again, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Chris and Wes. And let's see, I promised that after I chatted with Judika, I was going to share an article with you that just came out, it goes back to March, actually. One of my listeners sent it to me. It was in the Huffington Post. And, you know, we were having this conversation on Facebook, kind of along the lines of what would Jesus cut, what would Jesus buy, you know, why are all these Tea Party people who claim to be Christians so so hard on the poor and, so much into corporate greed and militarism and gun possession and the death penalty and oppose welfare and food stamps and health care, you know, all of those things because, you know, it just seems so strange and contradictory because those positions somehow aren't very Jesus-like, aren't very Christian. And Phil Zuckerman, a professor of sociology at Claremont College, actually here in my neck of the woods, I didn't realize that till just now. He wrote an article, Why Evangelicals Hate Jesus. The article was co-authored with Dan Cady. He's an assistant professor of history at California State University of Fresno. And anyway, I'm just going to read a little bit of this to you because it really helped me understand. I mean, it's easy enough to just say, oh, the hypocrisy. I don't know, this sort of explains a little bit. Anyway, it goes Phil Zuckerman on Huffington Post. You can find this if you want a copy for yourself. It's Why Evangelicals Hate Jesus. And it says, the results from a recent poll published by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life reveal what social scientists have known for a long time. White evangelical Christians are the group least likely to support politicians or policies that reflect the actual teachings of Jesus. It is perhaps one of the strangest, most dumbfounding ironies in contemporary American culture. Evangelical Christians who most fiercely proclaim they have a personal relationship with Christ, who most confidently declare their belief that the Bible is the inerrant word of God, who go to church on a regular basis, pray daily, listen to Christian music, place God and his holy, only begotten Son at the center of their lives, are simultaneously the very people most likely to reject his teachings and despise his radical message. Jesus unambiguously preached mercy and forgiveness. These are supposed to be cardinal virtues of the Christian faith. And yet evangelicals are the most supportive of the death penalty, draconian sentencing, punitive punishment over rehabilitation, and the governmental use of torture. Jesus exhorted humans to be loving, peaceful, and nonviolent. And yet evangelicals are the group of Americans most supportive of easy access weaponry, little to no regulation of handgun and semi-automatic gun ownership, not to mention the violent military invasion of various countries around the world. Jesus was very clear that the pursuit of wealth was inimical to the kingdom of God, that the rich are to be condemned, and that to be a follower of him means to give one's money to the poor. And yet evangelicals are the most supportive of corporate greed and capitalistic excess, and they are the most opposed to institutional help for the nation's poor, especially poor children. They hate anything that smack aspects of, quote, socialism, unquote, even though that is essentially what their savior preached. They despise food stamp programs, subsidies for schools, hospitals, job training, anything that might dare to help out those in need, even though helping out those in need was exactly what Jesus urged humans to do. In short, evangelicals are that segment of America which is the most pro-militaristic, pro-gun, and pro-corporate, while simultaneously claiming to be most ardent lovers of the Prince of Peace. So what's the deal? Well, Zuckerman explains is, he says, before attempting to answer, allow a quick clarification. Evangelicals don't exactly hate Jesus, as we've provocatively asserted in the title of this piece. They do love him dearly, but not because of what he tried to teach humanity. Rather, evangelicals love Jesus for what he does for them. Though his magical grace, and by shedding his precious blood, Jesus saves evangelicals from everlasting torture in hell and guarantees them a premium luxury villa in heaven. For this and only this, they love him. They can't stop thanking him. And yet, as for Jesus himself, his core values of peace, his core teachings of social justice, his core commandments of goodwill, well, most evangelicals seem to have nothing but disdain. And this is nothing new. At the end of World War I, the more rabid and often less educated evangelicals decried the influence of the social gospel amongst liberal churches. According to the self-proclaimed torchbearers of religion born in the Middle East, progressive churchgoers had been infected by foreign ideas such as German rationalism, Soviet-style communism, and, of course, atheistic Darwinism. In the 50s, the antisocial gospel message piggybacked the rhetoric of anti-communism, which slashed and burned its way through the Old South and onward through the Sun Belt, turning liberal churches into vacant lots along the way. It was here that the spirit and the body collided, leaving us with a prototypical Christian nationalist hell-bent on prosperity. Charity was thus rebranded as collectivism, and self-denial gave way to the gospel of accumulation. Church to church, sermon to sermon, evangelical preachers grew less comfortable with the fish and loaves Jesus who lived on earth and more committed to the angry Jesus of the future. By the 1990s, this divine terminator gained, quote, most favored Jesus status, unquote, among America's megachurches. And with that, even the mention of the former social justice messiah drove the socially conscious from their larger, meaner flock. In addition to such historical developments, there may very well simply be an underlining, all too human, socio-psychological process at root, one that probably plays itself out among all religious individuals, meaning they see in their religion what they want to see and deny or despise the rest. That is, religion is one big Rorschach test. People look at the content of their religious traditions, its teachings, its creed, its prophets, proclamations, and they basically pick and choose what suits their own secular outlook. They see in their faith what they want to see as they live their daily lives and simultaneously ignore the rest. And as is the case for most white evangelical Christians, what they are ignoring is actually the very heart and soul of Jesus' message, a message that emphasizes sharing, not greed, peacemaking, not warmongering, love, not violence. Well, you know, Christians don't corner the market on this. I mean, speaking for pagans, I am finding myself Republican pagans who don't seem to care much about environmentalism or social justice or the equality of women. And for me, it's hard to understand how they reconcile their spirituality and their politics as well. So I guess it's as Mr. Zuckerman said, you know, we see what we want to see and despise the rest. But, you know, I'm just here to say, as a goddess advocate, my belief is goddess ideals are about partnership and negotiation. They're about balance and justice and fairness and equality. And any political party or group that really perpetuates ideas that run counter to that, well, in my mind, they're not just immoral. And if you don't go along with those ideas, I don't think you can really call yourself a goddess advocate. That's my opinion. So anyway, I see we have a caller into the show. I don't know whether they're just listening or if they want to chat, but a caller from the 804 area code, I'm going to unmute you here for a second and see if you'd like to chat. Hi, are you there?
Yes, my name is Hugh. I'm calling from Virginia, and a very interesting dialogue. I have a Christ consciousness, and I'm actually trying to bring spirituality into global economics, and I could share a blog with you if you'd care to see a letter from President Obama to me related to the economy dated July 7, 2009. In addition to that, there's a very powerful little poem I created many years ago as a motivator in my own life. The poem is in the President Ronald Reagan Library. It's discussed as a weapon against terrorism in the interview that can be downloaded from the blog, and currently I'm using it to help the people of Haiti who can't help themselves. It's only three lines long. It's titled,
sure, go ahead, sir.
The poem is titled Caring, Sharing, and it reads, if you dare to care, then share. If you share, pay heed. God will reward every good deed. You can see it on a blog if you Google the word creativity, the number 777.com. And Jesus is right in what he taught. And we put all these people into office. We got exactly what we deserve. And my answer for what we're facing is to laugh and love them out of office and love in the right ones.
Well, I wish it, you know, I hear you and I believe what you're saying. I think it's going to be a little bit more difficult than that, though. They're gutter fighters, and they'll use any tactics to, you know, stay in office, lie, cheat, steal. And, I hope we can do that. You know, I hope we do, you know, have this awakening, and maybe it's happening. I mean, there were...
It is. It's not happening fast enough, unfortunately, but I will say there are things that can be done when... If people just stay peaceful and love is the answer to everything. But I exposed the former federal government bureaucrat for fraud via a front page Wall Street Journal article. It was dated Wednesday, April 27th, 1983, written by staff reporter Jonathan Quitney. And I believe this individual was a CIA operative at the time. He was engaged to the daughter of Jim Wright. Jim Wright went on to become the Speaker of the House, but that article put him in the spotlight. I was interviewed by a bureau chief from another newspaper who then dogged Mr. Wright until eventually he resigned the speaker position in shame. And that
we don't have any journalists like that anymore. That's part of the
problem,
don't
you think?
But if
you Wikipedia Jonathan Quitney, Quitny, he's the kind of journalist we need back, too. Yeah, big business, big government, and media are all in cahoots. They're taking away everything as quick as they can, and they're trying to, you know, work on the Internet, but they can't shut that down because they need that to spy on us. So what we have to do is look back at who's controlling us and why and start taking our freedoms back. And entrepreneurism is what built this country, and that's what will save the country, too. So
there was a very interesting, I just posted on my Facebook page today, I actually just found it, I don't think it's too old, Dylan Radigan really went kind of crazy on MSNBC telling Obama to just call out the Congress for being bought, you know, that they're all just bought, and he ought
they
to
are.
Go to
That's
the American
exactly
people.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, that Obama ought to go to America, to the American people, and spill the beans instead of being part of the problem, and, you know, try to turn things around like FDR did. And quite frankly, I mean, things are escalating so fast, or at least it seems to be. I think, you know, we need something bold. Something really bold like that to stop.
Well, that's why I'm standing in my truth. And if you can pick up on me, I'm looking for people to investigate me because I've had a lot of bizarre experiences over my lifetime. And I've been through pretty much everything and more than what people are going through right now. I've been through natural disasters, physical problems, personal bankruptcy. So, again, I stand in my truth. I'm self-proclaimed Hugh, the heartbeat of America. I live in Ashland, Virginia, which bills itself the center of the universe. And so I have a big message. I'm looking to get out there. And I actually created a very interesting product that is free to everyone. I'm bringing it from the spiritual realm into the physical realm. And it's just a common sense idea, but it will open up people's minds to show we all have unlimited creativity. I call the product the Y-Pod. Everybody's familiar with the iPod, but nobody's heard of the Y-Pod. And this can be used on and off the grid. And the Y-Pod stands for your personal opportunity database. And you empower it by what you put into it and how you interact with it. Off the grid, it can be as simple as an index card file of contacts and opportunities on the internet. It can be a website, a blog, a social media application, and those would be portals to a sophisticated computer-coded database of all kinds of pre-qualified global business opportunities. So there are things that can be done, and we don't have to be subject to these tyrants, the global elites that have these big multinationals. They're already starting to disintegrate from within. So spirituality is the important thing that we have to bring in. Transparency, making companies more responsible for their employees, customers, the environment, and the community.
Otherwise,
they're not going to be around in the future.
And like your quote at the beginning, sharing, caring, you know, all of that. I mean, they teach in Kabbalah that, you know, if you acquire for the self alone, well, you really just set yourself up for literal disease. The whole idea in acquiring a lot is to have more to share. And, you know, quite frankly, I can see that as a goddess ideal. So thank you so much for calling in, sir. I appreciate it. And I'm going to go ahead and mute you now, but you're welcome to hang in there with me and hear the rest of the show, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Well, listeners, as many of you know, Adversaries of the Sacred Feminine tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and sometimes disconnected men and their war gods, well, women and their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority was thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, and disrespected. That's why here on the show I'm dedicated to recovering the great she, whether she be a deity, an archetype, or an ideal. Yes, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women, to throw off the shackles and look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so that we know why things are the way they are today, how they have come to be so turned on their head and unnatural, and we're going to go about setting things right. Why? Well, because if we want to save ourselves as a species, I think we have no other choice. If we want to restore balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, it's women armed with our like-minded brothers and ideas of the sacred feminine who will set things back on course. So let me once again repeat what have become the mottos of the show. The first is, all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted for being self-evident. And the second, attributed to Gandhi, he said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. So I'd like to invite you to stay tuned with me for just a couple minutes more while I share some other important information. Then we'll close with some lovely music. So just a reminder out there, listeners, airtime here on Blog Talk, it's not free anymore, and I'm willing to give you a free gift if you can help support the show. If you can send in a contribution of $100, I'll send you my special 3 CD set of radio shows when I was on CBS discussing with other goddess advocates sacred places of goddess around the world. You can gift us nowhere but for me direct. It doesn't live on any archives on the internet. And if you donate less than $100, because I'm happy to get whatever you can donate, I'll send you one CD of those sacred places or an assortment of other thank you gifts. And please remember, or maybe it's the first time you've heard, Blog Talk is no longer free to hosts. you know, it's like what Goddess teaches, what we tend to, what we nurture, what we nourish, well, it thrives, and what you neglect, it withers. So thanks to those of you who have already sent in donations. I've already mentioned Chris and Wes, who most recently sent in donations, so thank you very much. And if you'd like to make a contribution, you can go to the Goddess Store page of my website at KarenTate.com. Scroll down toward the bottom of the page where the PayPal buttons are, and you can make a donation of any amount you can afford. And please, if you're looking at my show page on your computer screen, remember the three F's. I would love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Also, be sure to become our friend. But maybe most important is to click the follow button so that you never miss notice of my new guests each week, and that way you're a part of our growing family of listeners across the globe. And just in case you don't know a lot about me yet, I've actually written two books. And while we have a minute here and still have a bit of airtime left, I invite you to take a look at my website. My first book garnered prestigious endorsements and awards. It's actually sold in some museum bookstores. It's Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. And then my second book, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. Well, it tells you, you know, how to incorporate the sacred feminine into your life. It's sort of a spiritual, socio-political look at bringing the divine feminine, deity, archetype, or ideal into your life and into your community. And the Sacred Places book, well, whether you're an armchair traveler or somebody who actually has a passport and gets out there, it's for both. Many reviews have been outstanding as people felt the book actually took you there if you just aren't big on traveling. And besides teaching about Goddess and the particular destinations, it also teaches a lot about Goddess spirituality as well. So both books from my website, you can get them for $25 plus shipping and handling. Of course, I'll sign them for you. And just one of them alone actually retails for $24.95. So that's actually like two for one. And when you're there on my website, don't forget all the free stuff, because you know what? We all like free stuff, especially in these hard economic times, because there's free stuff on my website too. Besides the great articles and information and teaching aids, there are also free downloadable meditations. Those are also on the Goddess Store page. I also have a new article posted on the articles page that ran in the international magazine La Luz, and the article is titled The Inhumanity of the GOP, Always for Profits, Not People. So, let's see, future shows. I just wanted to tell you that I will actually be on vacation next Wednesday, so there will not be a show next Wednesday. But on the 24th, I'm going to have Professor Jane Caputi on the show. She's a professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies at Florida Atlantic University. She's written a number of books, all against patriarchal domination. One of them was The Age of Sex Crimes. The other was Gossips, Gorgons, and Crones, The Fates of the Earth and Goddesses. And the third is Monsters, Women, Myth, and Power and Popular Culture. And we're going to talk about stuff like, does patriarchal religion contribute to disrespect for and violence against the earth and women? She argues that serial killers of women are terrorists and as such are made into patriarchal cultural heroes. We're going to talk about, do we need a new religion, and what might God or Goddess look like or be like in an earth-respecting religion? So that promises to be very interesting. So as we come to a close for tonight, I am going to choose some nice music to go out on a positive note. And, you know, one of my favorites is always the stuff by Zingaya and Abigail Spinner McBride. So let me look in my database for something really good. Okay, let's do Om Sekhmet by Abigail Spinner McBride. And if you aren't familiar with Sekhmet, well, she is a lion-headed Egyptian goddess. And she is an archetype that many women today look to as a goddess of empowerment. She teaches women to have boundaries and to say no without guilt. She teaches all of us to have passion and strength and tenacity. In fact, I've sort of coined a name for her, Lady of Tenacity Manifested. So, to close the show tonight, a tribute to the beloved Sekhmet, and this is her song, "I'm Sekhmet" by Abigail Spinner McBride, and here it goes. Good night, listeners. See you again on August 24th, and in the meantime, please hit the archives. There's lots of good stuff there for you.